Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Oh, okay, so today was fun. I've always been a proponent of branching outside that comfort zone. Basically, the show has been a big proponent of anything that spends time in a barrel. Eventually, we're going to get some tequila guys in here. But tequila is a category that's I'm still learning and getting used to. I'm big on mezcals. But first, wine. Wine is something that I think most people who drink have had, you know, a significant memory of the first time they drank wine. I've got an interesting story behind wine that really got me hooked, and it involves a girl that I ended up marrying and have been together with for now 12 years? Okay. 12 years? 13 years? Something. I don't know. It feels like 40 years. Love you, honey. But yeah, so I did a little research and found out that Houston has a master sommelier here, and David Keck is a master somm that got into this business as an opera singer. He started as an opera singer, got into wine. Now he owns Goodnight Charlie's in Houston. Great name, by the way. And just a really down-to-earth guy and the opposite of a snob. When you say opera singer and you say sommelier, you're thinking this guy has some opinions about things. The dude could not have been more down to earth and more just didn't drink what you like. You know, there's some controversy over this or controversy over that, but it doesn't matter. A good product is a good product. So I had the absolute honor of having him on the show. This week's episode and the next few weeks, because for this month we're sponsored by both Girard Vineyards as well as Redemption. Redemption makes a bourbon and a rye whiskey. They released a 37-year-old last year. They've got a 10-year-old barrel strength that's absolutely fantastic. We talk a little bit about it all. They will be sponsoring us this month, as well as our friends over at Brown-Forman, Woodford Reserve, Jack Daniels, all of them. You know, you've heard me talk about them in depth. I'm a huge fan. So we were lucky enough to have a good friend of mine, Tony Costello, on. He's been a integral part of the bourbon community here in Houston over the past couple of years. He's been at every social event we've done. And by social, I mean the whiskey social, the event that I hold. And it just was just down-to-earth guys having conversation over drinks. It's like it's the best part of the show. So I hope it's as entertaining for you guys as it is for me just to sit here and watch us drink and rant. We were going to talk to Glenn Hugo, the winemaker for Girard, but we had some technical difficulties FaceTime. We had some technical difficulties with FaceTime, and we weren't able to speak with him, unfortunately. But that being said, we drank his wine, absolutely adored it. And just a reminder, every episode of Whiskey Neat can be found on iTunes, Google Play, Facebook, YouTube. I mean, we are on every platform that you can find the show. And it airs every week on Thursdays and then locally on radio at 94.1 FM Sports Map on Saturdays at noon. So click, like, follow, subscribe, the whole nine yards. And if you're watching this, the Whiskey Social's in a couple days. We're a week behind with recordings, so get your tickets now. We have added incredible things to the lineup this year, including a 70-year-old cognac. So from Maison Ferrand. HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. Check the event out on Facebook, Eventbrite, the whole nine yards, and then you can find everything for this show at MyWhiskeyNeat.com. Without further ado, David Keck, Master Sommelier David Keck, and Tony Costello from Redemption Girard. Cheers. You ready to drink at 10 o'clock in the morning?
Always, man. Actually, I'm in the wine business. You want to start here?
Yeah, let's start there because that weed is a little bit on the sweet side. So
this is Tyler's mistake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I saw the label approval for this. We You know, I peep out labels when they come through, especially when I hear something's coming through. If someone tells me something's coming and there's no label approval, I know it'll be another few months. So normally if I see it in the system, I know that we're just around the corner from it being released locally. Twist that around. So what's the Tyler mistake story?
So Tyler's mistake is literally a guy named Tyler who works in the warehouse where we bottle our small batch stuff. So we bottle all of our really small allocations in like nine barrel bottlings. Yeah. And so Tyler had some 2 and 3 year next to a tank that he was supposed to be putting all of our, those nine lovely barrels in. And with that 2 and 3 year, he actually ended up dumping a barrel of 9 year old bourbon in there. So you've got 2 and 3 year old rye.
Did Tyler keep his job?
Tyler still has his job. We actually might hire, you know, we should hire him as our backup distiller, I think, as our master blender.
Is this a new bottle design too? I thought they were shorter last time.
So this is the same bottle design that we have come out with here recently. So we used to be a tall, skinny bottle, but it looked like a vodka bottle or a rum bottle. So we just went to more of a traditional whiskey style and just wanted to make sure that everything that we're about is upfront on the label.
Yeah, that's a big part of what makes Barrel, I think, a success is they're just they're so transparent that there's no reason to give them a hard time. I think you're already kind of against the fence. Anytime you're a producer or a bottler, you're already kind of against some judgment, some preconceived notions that snobs have on certain things. And when you are so transparent and you kind of put together a decent product, then it's hard not to be left alone. You know, no one's going to pick on you.
Yeah, I don't think anybody picks on us. And you know, there's
not necessarily.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that come from where we come from. The key thing is that we just want to be transparent with it. You know, that's what Redemption's always been about. It's just like, hey, we're sourced, we're from MGP, but they've only been doing it like 160 years. So what do they know?
Yeah.
So it's like,
find a way to make it work.
Yeah, dude, if they've got all the processes in place, everything, I mean, they're sending back a truck to two truck every day of grains that aren't meeting their quality. So we're like, okay, we can continue this partnership.
Yeah. And you guys kind of bleed over to a little bit of wine. I know that, and it really is kind of, I didn't even know that Houston kind of gets ignored in a, and I've always said this, in a lot of different realms. Dallas and Austin has like the cultural scene, when Houston really does have one that I think largely gets overlooked. And I didn't even know that Houston had a master sommelier, let alone four of them.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal to be sitting across from you, and even more important, I'm going to have some wine here with you in a minute. Yeah. But thank you so much for being on the show.
Totally my pleasure.
Yeah, David, great to see you.
Good to see you, Tony.
Tony, always a pleasure.
Chris,
as well.
Great to see you as well.
Been a minute.
So let's get into this. You are currently the proprietor. It seems like such a abused word, but proprietor of Good Night Charlie's.
Yeah.
You guys do spirits as well as, you know, all alcohol, period. Just the whole thing.
Yeah, we try to cover as much of the spectrum as possible.
Yeah. So tell me your background. I know that you had a kind of an interesting story, which sure. I know parts of it, but and before we go there, so I told people a few episodes back when we talked to Steve Platts with NASA that this world, the spirits world, the alcohol world, drinking, the hobby, whether it's wine-related or bourbon-related, is full and rife with really interesting individuals. And the fact that we had the chief deputy scientist of the human research program on the show, awesome. or just any number of people.
Tough act to follow right there. Just me and Tony today.
It's amazing the people that you meet in this hobby. It's part of what makes it so much fun. So just to sit down with someone that has a very storied past, and you do have a very storied past, it's extremely exciting to kind of hear the background behind it. So without further ado, where did you get started that?
Sure. I mean, I started like most of us in this business at one point or another, waiting tables and bartending when I was 18, and then moved to New York to study and did my undergrad there, and then went into music as an opera singer for about, I don't know, until 10 years ago, something like that, which actually brought me to Houston, and came down here to do my master's at Rice. There was at the Shepherd School of Music, and a great teacher that I met while I was singing in Colorado, and came down to study with him, and And then was singing auditions and decided it was time for a little bit of a career change. Opera singers are like, we're on the road a lot as beverage professionals, but opera singers are on the road like 10 months out of the year. So I decided I wanted to see what it felt like to live in one place for a little bit. And right then,
came to Houston.
So and I was here. Yeah. So this was the place to be. And that was when I sat my first level SOM exam and was like, wow, this is cool. I could go down this rabbit hole for a while, which I think is why this business collects so many interesting folks, is it's so like multidisciplinary, and it definitely collects people who get sort of intrigued by, I mean, there's so much to talk about with beverage that you could talk about history, you can talk about chemistry, you can talk about, you know, basically geology, geography, climate, all of these things tie in. So it's like, oh, well, I could be in this rabbit hole for a while. Yeah, I started that path and then got hooked. So
it's a deep rabbit hole to go down. I mean, yeah. I thought about telling this story in the introduction, but I'll tell it now. When I was, you know, many years ago, when I met this girl, beautiful girl, way out of my league.
Easy.
But she, you know, we were talking back in the MySpace days, and we I don't know if you guys remember that, but
oh, yeah.
You know, she had said, you know, do you like wine? I never drank wine before. Oh yeah, I love wine. I've definitely. So we got together and I had no idea what I was doing. And, but pretty girl said she loves wine. That means I love wine too. So, I grabbed 100%. A couple of bottles. I went over to her house and I got to drink wine, and I couldn't get into it right away. But over time I've learned, and it's with anything in this, whether it's food, you know, a lot of people don't like sushi because of the texture, then you get them into it over a period of time and they learn to love it. And wine's the exact same way. Bourbon, you know, everyone starts off drinking bourbon mixed with Coke, and then you switch to an ice cube. And there's an evolution that happens with, you know, a rabbit hole for all of them.
Yeah.
So, So you were an opera singer, you got into wine. How did you get into wine from opera singing? I don't understand what the catalyst was.
All while I was in New York, I was kind of bartending on the side and working in the industry off and on. And then it was actually a very close friend and a conductor that I was working with in New York, and a coach who he and his partner had been going to France since the 70s, collecting wine, bringing back wine with them. Back in the days when you could like go and knock on people whose doors you cannot even approach now, like they were just going by and, oh, just go say hi to Jean-Louis Chave and hang out with the Chave family for a while. Like people that, you know, are kind of iconic figures now, they were just hanging out with. And so Ken kind of found out that I liked wine and that I was interested in it, kind of begun the path, but really was still very much in the music world, and said, well, come over for dinner and we'll open some wine and whatever. And I brought my one bottle of wine. It was not where they were with the whole thing. And so said, oh, well, you know, and they're super gracious folks, said, oh, well, that's a nice bottle of wine. But if you're going to try that, then we should also try this. And then we should try this. And then we should try this. And by the end of a meal at their apartment, there's like 12 bottles, 15 bottles on the table for, you know, four people. And just trying all this stuff. And that was when I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like there's like fine wine is really an, there's so much more to this than I really thought. And so, and singers like to drink.
Oh, for sure. So much of what you're saying mirrors the bourbon world. And one thing that I've tried to do on the show, at least, is kind of get people outside their comfort zones. I got started in Scotch and was very reluctant to be a big enthusiast of bourbon, because I felt like it was such a narrow category. And meaning, you know, with Scotch, you can go sherry, you can go peat, you can, I mean, the spectrum of potential cognac finish. And now people are doing that with bourbon, although it's not technically bourbon anymore, the finishes, but it was such a narrower range of flavors that I just felt like it was boring almost. So, so the bottle shares thing, the dinner, that's, we've done that. We've gotten together. It's such a closely related field that on the show I try to get people into rums and wines and so that sort of thing. So
And I think all of the beverage world really ties together at a certain point, and it may not be your choice, right? It may not be the spirit or the you know, alcoholic beverage, beer, you know, that you really maybe enjoy up front. But again, like, I think it's all about education and getting people together to, you know, that was one of the ways when I moved here before I was like really seriously into wine, just get, you know, 10, 15 people together for dinner and everybody brings a bottle just so you can, you know, we cook dinner and open a bunch of things so you can try them together. Sure. And you're not going to like everything. That's never the point, right? The point is not to like everything you put in your mouth, but to actually be like, oh, well, this is a thing I don't like. I learned something now. You know, like, I'm not going to do that again. Or maybe I'll like it later. But
sure. Yeah, it's what Pete's like. Every time I introduce someone to something Pete did, they don't like it at first. But over time, you force enough Pete into them, then they learn. They acclimate. You learn to enjoy something. And I ended up marrying that girl, for the record. That's my wife. So you learn to appreciate something. There's a reason that there's an entire culture around rum or wine. Because it's something that you, like you said, it's a deep rabbit hole that anyone can go down if you just have the right, that right moment of introduction that ends up making you obsessed.
I'm still waiting for my Malort moment. I haven't gotten there with Jessen's Malort yet, but I think, you know,
there's a lot of people who enjoy that.
There are.
And I've never heard of it until recently, and I've never tasted it.
Consider yourself the fortunate few. Stay away from that.
It's an old thing, right? It's been.
Yeah. It's a Chicago. It's like a Chicago liqueur that is.
Pungent?
Yeah, it's intense. Yeah. It tastes like the ashes of the Chicago fires, like drowned Midwestern dreams. Like it tastes like we came up with a lot of solid adjectives the last time I tried it, or similes. And it's a tragic beverage, in my opinion. But there are a lot of bartenders using it to do cool stuff, and it is a unique beverage. I will tell you that it tastes like nothing else.
When is this coming out officially?
So this just got into the market right now, and thank goodness whenever this podcast stairs, it should all be out of the warehouse.
So. what's the price point? What are we talking locally?
Less than $50.
Okay.
$50 for
9-year-old bourbon and 2 to 3-year-old rye blended in.
Nope.
You got it. 456 packs were made. That's it.
What's the proof point?
Proof point is 94.
Okay. So. I like a nice little bump.
Yeah.
Me too. I like a little bit higher proof. With Redemption, except for our bourbon, we're always in the 90s.
What was that 37-year-old monster we had in the fall?
Yeah, that was insane. The 36-year-old
Redemption. What was the proof on that?
So that one was in the low 90s. I want to say it was 92.
So it's the oldest one y'all released, but it's not the oldest bourbon ever released, is it?
No, not at all. Well, the final word is – or the last word has just come out with a 45-year-old bourbon.
Okay.
Which is crazy. I think it's the final word.
And have you tasted anything? It's just awful. Just
scraping the bottom of the
barrel. It's just awful.
I think we could squeeze a little more out of these staves to just bottle this.
That's what it tastes like. Is it tastes like the the Devil's Cut. I think Jim Beam came out with a few years back where they would literally take the wood and they would press it like a sponge to get out what juice they could and then blend it with some stuff. Yeah. The nose on it was phenomenal. When we tasted it at Rosewater, 36-year, right? 36-year-old bourbon. The nose on it was great. The color was shoe polish.
It looked like charcoal, like a charcoal filter system.
Nothing about it aesthetically was pretty. It was very ugly. In fact, I've got about half an ounce left, and I gave it to my wife, and she's like, I'm not looking for it. Yep. Yeah. She hasn't tried it yet because it looks just – like
tragic,
and it looks intense. Now it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Being able to taste, I'm always fascinated with older or unique expressions because you're tasting something that might have been distilled differently. The process was a little different. 100%. The equipment was a little older.
Yeah.
And it was something that smelled great, and I would have bought a bottle for sure. The problem was there were no bottles to buy locally, except for what went to Rosewater. But now the 18-year-old rye that came with it, phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. But the 36-year-old bourbon was a great experience, but it just tasted like wood water is the best way to say that. Wood water, old wood water.
Now, some things, I've had wines that have been in barrel for 100 years, and it's like sometimes great, sometimes really not, right? Like bizarre.
So I don't have a lot of experience in the wine world, short of a meat cute story. I've always wondered two things. One, I understand that wine's essentially a living entity. Like it's constantly changing both in the bottle and in the barrel, whereas whiskey is pretty – its growth is in the barrel. Once it's in the bottle, it's done.
It's pretty much done.
Pretty much done. There's some articles have been written about some slow chemical changes over a long period of time.
Sure.
But one – and this is going to sound – ignorant how this comes out, so just bear with me here. How do they add you add sulfites to
sometimes
help? So is it added into the barrel or during the bottling process?
Any number of different techniques on that. Some people just sulfur at bottling. Some people sulfur in the barrel. Some people.
And how do you do that? How do you add sulfur to the barrel?
Actually, just adding SO2 like. To it, and it's a basically, I mean, there's this huge, I have a great shirt that I picked up. I was just traveling in Greece and there's a winemaker who just went off about the presence of sulfur in the wine community. And
he hated it.
No, he's a huge fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he's the opposite. So there's a huge like movement right now, the natural wine movement and, you know, no sulfur. But SO2, listen, like life wouldn't exist on Earth without SO2. And adding it is a wine making technique that has existed for a very long time, and it creates stability in a wine, right? Like a little SO2 stabilizes a substance that usually needs it. And so, like you said, it's kind of a living substance. And so those who don't use sulfur, some of the wines are great. Some of them are stable. They're well made. There's a lot of stuff that ends up, you open a bottle and it's volatile, right? Like it started to ferment.
It's rancid. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Something happened, right? So a little bit of sulfur goes a long way. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of folks who just say, you know, I use as little as possible. I do it right at bottling. Just, you know, just a touch in the bottling
process. So the actual maturation process is pure.
Yeah.
It's unadulterated.
And so that it's the wine and there's nothing in there that's going to be any sort of volatile compounds that are going to become active, right? Which I think there's not really anything wrong with that.
So you don't think that there's anything wrong with it whatsoever? You think it's more
I don't think so. I mean, you know, the whole idea of intervention in wine and any process at all, right? Like, do you, in your rick house, do you actually temperature control? Do you not temperature control? There are so many ways you can either mess with a beverage or not, right? I think the goal is at the end of the day to make a great beverage. So great winemakers want to do as little as possible, add as little, take away as little as they possibly can to just have a very clean expression of those grapes in that year, in that place. But if you're concerned about like issues in the vineyard, if you have issues in the winery or something in the fermentation, like anything you need to do to make sure that that wine is like complete and as pure an expression of those things without becoming volatile, without having, you know, fermentation issues, without having issues like in rot and things like that in the vineyard, then most people should do that, I think. Like, make the best possible beverage.
It's almost, not to go down this road of we talked beforehand about not going political, but it's almost like the anti-vaxxer movement, or it's almost like it's a push towards, basically nowadays everyone's questioning everything. Yes. Everyone's saying, all right, we may have always done it this way, but let's go, you know, there's a lot of people who love raw milk and it's completely illegal to sell it. And there's some places that locally that actually make it. You know, there's always a push to kind of go away from any progress we've had to the olden days. But absolutely, the olden days aren't necessarily a good thing.
Not always. But I think, like, there's a winemaker who's a friend up in Vermont who works with, like, hybrid varieties that are a combination of, like, Vitis vinifera, so what most wine is made from, with native varieties to the United States, right? And works exclusively biodynamically, uses like no chemicals, almost no intervention at all. And her wines are spectacular, but she is in the vineyard every day and knows how, okay, well, this is what's happening in the vineyard. I'm going to need like nettle tea, or I'm going to need this or different. Like basically it's homeopathic medicine for a vineyard. She's very good at it. Like it takes a long time and you have to study and you make mistakes, and she's made wines that she's not happy about, and she makes wines that are gorgeous now, but there's been a lot of a learning process there.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a little bit of a movement right now that it's like, we're going to do away with all this stuff without actually having the education or the training and the experience and wisdom of years of practice to do it well. Like, you don't go without vaccines if you don't know how to keep yourself like healthy.
Well, that actually brings us to Girard, which is perfect because Girard is a winery that I thought of exactly whenever we were talking about this conversation. They actually don't add any yeast unless it's absolutely necessary. So they do all indigenous fermentation. You know, they're not adding sulfites unless they absolutely have to. But what most people don't realize is sulfites are already there. They're a byproduct of fermentation. Yeah. In organic wine, you have sulfites in organic wine. Now you have the least amount of sulfites, but they're always going to be there in the wine. So
now
as you pull away
wine.
From
let's,
it.
Let's open
yeah,
one.
Go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I got a couple ready.
Yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's. Do you want to start with the – because I wanted to get into the whole bourbon discussion before we bring on your master winemaker. How do you want to do this? We can go bourbon barrel age first, because we can get to that discussion talking about
Let's do that towards the end in case we have time, but let's go into the wine part.
Sounds good.
Well, this might be a good time for Glenn, do you think?
We'll save that for the third segment.
Cool.
But I definitely want to hear more about this.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting...
It's hard to tell people that it's my job to drink at 10 o'clock in the morning on Wednesdays.
Somebody's got
to
do it, man.
It's a hard sell for some people.
Yeah.
So opera singer turned master sommelier turned proprietor.
Mm-hmm.
What, first of all, okay, I'm sure anyone who hears that you're a master somm has got to bring up the Netflix series, right?
Yeah, of course.
So I watched that series, I want to say maybe, I don't know, it's probably 3 years ago. I don't remember who all was in it. But how hard is the process? I mean, how many different steps between somm and master somm are there? And
sure. I mean, the quick story is that it's pretty impossible. It, from a statistics standpoint, you know, you brought up NASA there. Actually, Greg Harrington, who's a master sommelier in Washington, great winemaker up there, likes to say there are more astronauts than master sommeliers. So it's a pretty, it's an involved process, and it's four steps. There's sort of an intro course, which is 2 days, and the pass rate is pretty high. And generally, it's kind of an introduction to the world of wine over 2 days, instructed by master sommeliers. Then the second level is a certified exam, which is basically the structure of the rest of the exams, which is a theory portion, blind tasting, and then a service exam. And then basically you go from there. Pretty substantial jump to the advanced exam, which is, again, those three things, but just in more depth and concentration. And then the master's exam is a verbal exam, theory exam, followed by a blind tasting of 6 wines in 25 minutes, and then a service exam. And all of them are, I mean, the pass rate is still quite low for the exam. And I think it, you know, we continue to learn more about the world of wine, and more information is always accessible, so it gets more and more challenging. But I think our expectations for sommeliers continue to increase as well.
So three official steps with one beginning kind of introduction.
Sure.
And you're a master somm. Now, from what I remember from the show, these people were able to nail down region of where the grapes are coming from what you're tasting. So you could theoretically taste this and say, I could tell you what country or what, how specific are we getting?
I mean, it should boil down to basically country, region, sub-region, quality level, if that is a thing. So if you're dealing with like Spanish wines, is it Reserva? Is it Grand Reserva? And then grape variety or blend of varieties and what those might be, and then vintage.
And how accurate do you have to be in this test?
Pretty accurate.
Got to know it all.
Well, and again, it moves, you know, from the second level there, the certified exam. Sure. I mean, we kind of give a little bit more framework for that. By the master's level, you got 25 minutes one time a year to pass that test. So
what, and I'm more of a red guy, but so what are we drinking? Tell me, what's the story here?
So this is the Sauvignon Blanc from Girard, and this is one of the varietals that they actually own property on, so they have their estate-owned Sauvignon Blanc in there. They do put a couple of other family vineyards that they work with. Glenn will talk a lot about Girard, but it's basically a winery that was founded by Steve Girard, and it was purchased by the Rudd family. I'm sure you're familiar with them, in 1999. But Girard was a great label, and it was, you know, founded by a great guy, and so we kind of wanted to carry on that legacy. And so Pat Rooney and Marco DiGiulio said, hey, let's work on this together. And so they purchased the Girard label from Steve. And now we have 20 to 25-year-old contracts that we're still sourcing Napa Valley Cabernet Franc or Napa Valley Petit Syrah from. It's just incredible the quality that we've gotten for as long as we have, because they saw the foresight back in the late 90s. Let's get as long as we can in these. But with our Sauvignon Blanc here, there's only about 10,000 cases produced, maybe 8,000 this year. Always gets 89, 90 points, somewhere around in there. And it comes from three different vineyard sites, one of them being the estate that they own.
So, and another ignorant question, me not being a white guy. Me being a literal white guy, but me not being a white wine drinker. Are these barrel aged? I know that seems like such a stupid question.
No, that's a great, that's a great question.
Totally legitimate question.
What's the, Yeah. So I'm sorry. My mind's racing with thoughts over while you're talking about this whole process. There's a local guy, Michael Canfield, who, you know, Michael, right?
Yeah.
I think you may have met him. He introduced me to a bottle of wine not too long ago that was, it's a picture of a woman on it. And it's supposed to be this extremely rare bottling. Its initials
could be anything.
It has to be one of the Machete labels.
Maybe? No, it's one of the initials that it's like, I'm just going to throw something out there. It's like YSL or something. And it's a very boutique-y blend that's extremely rare. Everything's like $1,000 or more.
Wow, okay.
I'm trying to remember.
Need to hang out with Mr. Canfield more often.
Right. Yeah, this is how ignorant I am when it comes to wine because, you know, I love the entire barrel realm. I'm a huge fan of. But, you know, I know very little short of, you know, 19 Crimes or some typical Spanish wines. Like I love Tempranillos. I love, I'm not so much on the I love Malbecs, but Merlots, but I love, you know, Cab's a hugely popular category. But I wish I could remember what that was. I'll find it at our next break. I'll reach out to Michael and find out what it is.
There's just so much spectrum though. I mean, like how many whiskeys do you taste in a year?
Yeah.
And, you know,
trying to remember all
barrel char.
I take pictures Nashville. All the time because I, you know, we taste hundreds of wines a year, sometimes thousands, and you're like, okay, well, I got to go back and, you know, remember what that one thing was that was really good, made by that one person in that one place. You know, I take pictures of everything.
You get that question, you know, what's your favorite? It's so hard to. It's such a question that someone who doesn't drink asks, like, you know what I mean? How are you supposed to do you
what's
have a favorite wine
right now?
Yeah.
No, I have to stop. What's my favorite wine right now? Well, the one in my glass. Like, what is my favorite wine in 5 hours?
I mean, you go through moods and phases and stuff. And to me, this tastes great. Like, I'm very happy. I'm not a white wine drinker, but and you're doing something that I've talked about recently. So there's a local guy, Wade, who got into a habit of doing blind taste tests.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get like 20 bottles of something, sample them all out, completely blind.
Yeah.
And trying to really, because you're putting yourself out there when you rate something blind.
Sure, of course.
Yeah. Don't want to look stupid.
Yeah. I mean.
And something I had started doing, I don't remember where I picked it up at, was what you're doing when you taste wine. And then someone's like, oh, that's a wine move.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's a word for it.
It works well. I mean, it's so the slurping. I just call it slurping, aerating. Yeah. I mean, and it's pretty straightforward. Like, I mean, and we do it, and I'm here to tell you, excuse me, kind of frog, but like if you're on a date, for example, or with your wife or whatever, I've been informed that
it's embarrassing.
It's okay when you first get the wine on the table, but if you're still doing it by the end of the bottle, you're driving everyone nuts.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Stop. But when in wine tasting, I mean, we can smell about 10,000 different things, 15,000 individual aromas, and it's our most retained sense memory. We can taste like five things, right? And so when you actually taste a wine, or whiskey actually, or anything else, you've just shut down, you know, the 15,000 potential things you may have smelled. And so by actually drawing air through it, you can retronasally smell it again, sort of while you're tasting.
Right, you're right. You're essentially you're smelling through your taste. Like
exactly.
you're bringing those aromas into your mouth and
bingo.
Yeah. So it's something that works real well with bourbon.
Yeah.
It's a little, I think it works, lighter stuff makes it easier to hone in, you know, like Peter from Federal Grill gave me a blind sample and I had nailed the maker and then the product within two guesses. So complete luck. I definitely couldn't do that again, but so Scotch has a lot more lighter notes, whereas bourbon is so much more intense and the burn is a lot, you know, more robust, but it's something that I've noticed really helps trying to pick apart whether or not you enjoy something.
Absolutely.
I've found stuff that I don't like through that method where I've always drank it and thought this is, you know, it's a good daily drinker. Using that method, I've changed my mind about a product. And
for
it's
sure.
something that I think is again, another thing that works across wine or bourbon or whatever.
Yeah. I think it just helps sort of sense and dial in on some of the complexity of the beverage. So, or lack of, right? Sometimes it's like, oh, that's not a lot of
very one note, yeah.
So a lot of people don't know this when you're talking about barrel aging this wine. So these are all red wines, but the juice that comes out for the most part is almost clear. So you have to impart color by adding tannin or by adding the skins after you ferment it. And that's what imparts the color, the tannin and stuff like that. With white wine, we actually don't do that for the most part. Very rarely do people do it. Usually we don't do that. In white wines, they want to keep them light, bright, and acidic, so they don't put it in barrel. After we allow those skins and stems and seeds to sit on the red wine, that's whenever we barrel it. So whites are usually kept out of barrel unless it's Chardonnay.
How long do you typically age a wine? I know that's a huge – I realized that even before it came out of my mouth. But what I mean is, bourbons tend – classic bourbons, Kentucky bourbons, you see six plus years. Mm-hmm. So what's is there a standard for minimum for, like, let's say California Reds?
Well, so think about the – oh, well, I'll let you answer. I'll just bring up one example, that 36-year-old bourbon that we had.
Yeah.
Well, that will, kind of settle in the bottle. But with this, it will continue to evolve in the bottle. So it's not just about how long you age it in oak for. It's also how long you have it laying down for as well. And it'll go through cycles of – positives and negatives and upswings and downswings, where if you drank it a year ago versus a year, a year later, it may taste completely different.
Well, and I think, bourbon's a prime example, right? Like, there are regulations in bourbon as far as labeling laws. So you can, if you're going to put bonded, it has to spend X amount of years in a bonded warehouse. If you're going to put straight bourbon, if you're going to put, all of the different labeling laws have different requirements for time in barrel. Wine is not totally dissimilar. The United States and a lot of the, what we would call the New World, right? The US, Australia, New Zealand kind of don't care too much about those regulations, and frequently they don't exist, a little bit, but less so. Whereas if you go to, like, Spain, if you see, and I mentioned, like, Reserva or Gran Reserva, those have specific regulations for how long it needs to be in barrel before you can actually put it in the bottle. And some of them, how long it needs to be in the bottle before you can release it to the consumer. So I think, like, there are a lot of similarities with respect to different places and how much time it needs to spend in barrel. For wines like these, Girard, they have no regulation. Is there a standard? Yeah, it really depends on the style of wine. Like, a lighter red wine that's meant to be consumed young isn't going to spend a whole lot of time in oak, most likely. A bigger, fleshier style of wine that needs a little bit of oxidation and time to just settle down because it's got a lot of tannin or a lot of structure to it, it will spend more time. It just depends on the wine. And a lot of times the winemaker makes that decision after they've fermented the juice, and then they say, oh, this wine needs another 18 months in oak, or it needs 6 months. So,
and we'll even bottle age or barrel age something for 12 or 18 months and then bottle age it for 6 months before we release it.
Yeah.
And we'll do that just because it needs time to just relax in the bottle and get going. But there is no limited amount of time. The other day I was out at a restaurant and had an amazing 1998 Cabernet that they had. It was a Cabernet heavy Bordeaux blend, but it was 20 years old and it was incredible.
People say, well, alcohol evaporates faster than water. So why is it that a barrel of bourbon would go up in proof? And that's strictly to do with a couple things. It's so hot in the U.S. compared to the Scotland or whatever. And the water molecule is so much smaller than that of the alcohol molecule. So a lot of times what we have here in the U.S. is an increase in alcohol proof, whereas in Scotland you normally see a decrease. So it's also a much slower evaporation process too. I think they see something like 1-2% a year. Mm-hmm. We see as high as 6% depending on how hot it is. But I didn't know how that worked with wine, if it was a slower process because there's a lot less alcohol and more water.
Other stuff. I don't know the answer. I mean, my guess is that it just is much slower because of that. And also, you're not really, generally speaking, your wine is not aging in a place that you're keeping it at 55 degrees as opposed to a rick house in Kentucky somewhere where
on the top floor where
you're actually looking at encouraging that, like, shift
140
in temperature,
degrees right? in temp.
So, I mean, most wine, unless you're talking about Madeira or something like that, you're really looking at trying to keep it at cellar temperature and in a cool, dark place. So
Texas was, we're known to be a lot hotter than Kentucky and a lot less fluctuation in temp. Our climate's very consistent. And I know that, have you ever been to Garrison's and High?
I have not been to Garrison's yet, but I've heard the troubles.
Yeah. They were aging for a long time in shipping containers, and they'd get like 200 degrees in there. And they're
crazy.
Literally cooking their bourbon. So, Well, and what questions did you have with whiskey?
Well, so
how can I make you
dorky?
What could I teach you?
Well, I'm curious
I'm a
about
master...
the increase in proof, right? Like, larger, larger molecules that, generally speaking, like we think of alcohol for evaporating faster than water, but obviously that's not the case. If you're ending up with, you know, barrel proof is always higher, and the longer it stays in barrel, the proof tends to increase in Kentucky. So why is that actually?
Like, so what is because of the heat, right? So the hotter and hotter it gets. I know that sometimes, like for instance, Beam has, you know, I think their brick houses are six stories, whereas Four Roses only has one story brick houses, which means you'll never see a hazmat offering from Four Roses. They typically see their barrel strength sitting around 130, mm-hmm. give or take, very rarely at 135, and they've never seen anything over like 136. So it's there's a lot less fluctuation in temperature than it is in a rick house. Right. You know what it's like. Have you ever set a coffee mug on a coffee warmer, mm-hmm. and you'll notice over the day that coffee will just slowly decrease?
Right.
Yeah, you're heating up that water, and in a bourbon barrel, the molecule's so much smaller than the alcohol molecule that it's easier to get out into the wood. Right. So that fluctuation, right. I think it's negative. It might be, I think it's 44 degrees. At 44 degrees, there's no interaction between bourbon and wood. I always forget the exact number. But essentially, aging in a barrel stops with whiskey once it hits below a certain amount, meaning that there's no interaction right. with the wood. It's stopped. And I forget what number it is. I'm sure someone's listening screaming at their radio right now. But with the hotter temperatures, it's a lot more interaction with the wood. It goes deeper into the wood. And so right. your water molecules are quickliest getting into the wood as opposed to the alcohol molecule. So what you typically see is an evaporation right, or okay. an escape Got of it. Water faster than alcohol molecules, which right. is why the proof goes up. Whereas in Scotland and in France, they use wet cellars mm-hmm. where they actually bring in moisture from outside the barrel into the barrel. So it causes right. the proof to go down.
To decrease. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why you see these 80-year-old cognacs at 80 proof because they check it as it ages, and then at a certain point you gotta stop it because then you can't release it at 30 proof.
Sure.
But I think Maison Ferrand, they're bringing a bottle of their ancestral to the event next week, and it's a blend of 60 and 70 year old cognac.
Wow.
And it's at 80 proof. So I'm interested to see something at 60s because I had a 45-year-old cognac Armagnac recently that was, again, it was very questionable.
I saw that,
but yeah. it was at cash strength. So it was literally just dumped from the thing into a sample bottle for us to taste because we do. Are you familiar with L'Incantata?
No.
So they're a French Armagnac producer that sources from these small domains, these little family okay. estates. And Armagnac is a tough category, yeah, right? So the only thing that Spec sells less of than Armagnac is Grappa. So it's a very, very slow-moving category. But in the bourbon world, at least on the national scale, L'Incantata releases these, and we talked about this last week. So Alexander Gabriel said that for years that the cognac business became standardized. Everything was released at 80 proof. Right. I mean, it's all boring. Like, it's the same stuff. Different age statements, yeah, sure, but yeah, nothing crazy going on.
Yeah, well, and a lot of that dictated by French labeling law, right? The INAO dictates pretty much everything about how you can produce cognac to the percentage of alcohol at, you know, after distillation, at barreling, at bottling. All of that is in the wine law. Like, sure. They don't have a choice, which is insane.
And you're faced with two problems. As on top of it being a boring category overall with as far as releasing something vibrant or new or crazy, the other half of that category is stereotyped. There are, cognac, there are people who won't drink, certain spirits because of the perception of that spirit as whatever the reason, vodka. Sure. I know a lot of people who won't drink flavored vodkas. I know a lot of people who won't drink, flavored whiskeys. So there, I had a conversation yesterday with someone about bacon flavored bourbon.
Yum.
No one's drinking that. So, anyway, so they're producing a lot of cash strength, super old expressions That's for crazy. Crazy prices. So I had bought a 31-year-old bottle from them for 65 euros.
That's crazy.
And you're like, well, how are they making any money on that? But that's the thing. So, and it's 51% alcohol. So you're getting a real vibrant, unwatered down product, 31 years old. I mean, you're getting just a purely fascinating raw barrel product from something. And a bourbon that's 31 years old is $1,800 or something. So,
yeah.
Which is not a bad price.
Yeah.
No, it's just bourbon right now is on the upswing so much that even 20-year-old whiskeys are crazy expensive. Whereas you can get some old Armagnacs, which is a cousin of whiskey. I mean, it's just right. They're right. Yeah. They might as well be cousins.
Different distillate, but
right. Distillate, but you're talking
but
about.
But you're talking about essentially, I mean, any distilled product, right? You're kind of like, how much are you boiling down to the actual, the base of that thing? So much of it is aging, and the aging process is so similar, you know. Just different. Yeah.
So we're buying two barrels of it. We're buying two barrels, and they're going to yield, I think one's 28 years old, one's 30 years old. They're going to yield 400 bottles each. And we're looking at maybe $100 or something. Because once you import it and get it here, $120, something like that. But it's just, if you're a big bourbon fan, you can get a super aged product at a very reasonable price. Yeah, I had a recently, Old Fitzgerald came out with their 11-year-old. 11-year-old. Pretty decanter, $120. We can get something three times as old, you know, a little higher proof. And it's not to say that Old Fitzgerald is overpriced. It's not. It's just you're talking about something that's comparable, and you get to get outside your comfort zone and try something new. Well,
and so I have a question for you, and I don't mean this to be in any way. Like, we sell a lot of bourbon, and I'm fascinated by it and been trying to learn as fast as I can and as much as I can from those who are obviously a lot more knowledgeable than I am with it. I think one of the questions that I have about bourbon is that, like, you said you started as a Scotch drinker. Like, regional specificity is really a thing in Scotland, right?
Terroir.
The idea of terroir, right? And so I have a hard time wrapping my head around that in bourbon production, just simply because a lot of it is distillate coming from somewhere else, so there isn't a sense of place with the base spirit, right? And then it's aged in a place, but a lot of those are similar, right? And then, so I'm curious, I think some of the terroir comes from a lot of yeast selection, as far as I can understand. Some of it's oak selection, some of it's rickhouse construction, but
I have lots of opinions about this.
It's unbelievable to think all these little things that make up all these differences. But when you look at some of the things that High West in Utah has put out versus some of the stuff Smooth Ambler, Old Scout has put out down in Alabama, right?
No, they're in I always forget where it is. I've never been there. Smooth Ambler is like in North Carolina or something. I forget exactly where. It's in the West or in the East.
But either way, these different climates, Virginia, just like with wine, you know, like we can get – it's all climate-based really is what – imparts everything because it's all a distilled spirit. And then you got all your mash bills, then you got all your different types of oak. I mean, it can get as deep as you want.
But any of those things you can do in any place except for the aging process, right?
Yeah, so to answer your question, the answer to that question is no one knows why. Because it's something that Texas is fighting greatly because Kentucky and Indiana have mastered this 150 years, 200 years of making bourbon a way that tastes like what people think bourbon tastes like.
Sure.
And you've got these other states who are trying to release whiskey, and they haven't quite figured out why theirs doesn't taste like theirs. And I don't mean specifically, why does mine not taste like Woodford Reserve? Their question is, why does mine not taste like what Kentucky bourbon in general tastes like? And no one's been able to nail it down. There's, you know, shout out to Iron Root. And Denison, Robert and his brother Jonathan have been doing everything they can to kind of figure out the Texas category. Because the Texas category, although I think is on the upswing as far as sales go, like people are very proud of Texas. Mm-hmm. But in the realm of fanatics, Texas is not looked upon with great respect. And initially, what people were doing in Texas were using small barrels to age quicker. It was not yielding great results. Some distilleries have moved up in size. Some were cooking them in storage containers.
Well, it seems like a small barrel is redundant in the Texas heat. Like, you're already going to speed up the aging process, are you not, with that kind of
– Yeah, but you want to produce something in 6 months, not two years.
So speeding it up to like –
Yeah, so now a lot of Texas distilleries have moved away from that initial thought and are now producing 2 to 3 year whiskeys, some of them a little older. They are all, as a category, in their infant stages, they are progressing in the right direction. Even TX, who was sourcing whiskey, adding vanilla flavoring to it, wildly popular, TX blended whiskey, they released a straight bourbon a couple years ago. They're trying to get into that category of their own distillate, 4 years, or I think theirs is a little under 4 years. Anyways, point is that we don't know what it is. A lot of distilleries have moved up from the smaller barrels.
Yeah.
I know that, I think Iron Root, he's told me this. Forgive me, Robert. I think he said he's using 60-gallon barrels, which is more than what Kentucky's using.
Yeah.
The thought being that if it ages quicker here, maybe we should go bigger in barrels mm-hmm. because it's a slower process the bigger the barrel is. So they're all trying to figure that out. Terroir is real. They can have similar mash bills. The one guy that's doing it right, and no one can figure out how, is Whitmire's in Houston.
Yeah.
Whitmire's is producing, in my opinion, at no slight to anyone else, the best Texas bourbon right now. And I don't know how he's doing it. Sure. I know what his mash bill is. He doesn't hide it. He's using smaller barrels, 30-gallon barrels.
Okay.
And he's putting out 2 to 3 year products. I know we had something that was, I want to say 30 months at one point, and it tastes the closest thing to what you think Kentucky bourbon tastes like. So we're like, how is this guy not like world famous? Some of these other Texas distilleries have like these massive, they're selling product all over the states, where Whitmire's is like this little quiet gym in Houston tucked away, not even technically in Houston. It's in the unincorporated part. Terroir is real. I'm with you 100%. I don't know. No one's figured it out. I've sat down with the guys from Iron Root, and they've had me taste some of their distillate. They're getting a lot of input from the consumer. I know that the Liquor Hound in Dallas, do you know Chris Trevino?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's got a great YouTube channel where he reviews stuff, and he's very popular, the Liquor Hound. He consults with a lot of Texas distilleries, and no one's quite been able to figure out why Texas is not working, but other states are.
Yeah.
I think it's got to be something with the climate. It's got to be something with the climate. I don't know what else it could be. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, they say it's a question of, I mean, and Texas wine is in kind of some similar spot, although I think they're really starting to hit their stride in many respects, but it's like, you know, that friggin' diurnal temperature shift thing is real, and it doesn't exist in Texas in the same way. And they'll say, you know, in hill country and up in Texas high plains and things like that, there is some diurnal temperature shift, but it's not Kentucky, you know, it's not that. And so I can't help but think that that has to play a role in it. And I'm sure humidity and all sorts of other things play
barometric pressures, everything that we get down here from the coastal waters. There's so much influence.
But yeah, I'm fascinated by, you know, talking with distillers too about yeast selection and about,
well, you know what's funny about that? All that. Yeast is a big. I'm sorry. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. This is fine. So yeast is a big selling point for Vore Roses.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Yeast is a big selling point for a lot of, you know, sour mash. You're familiar with keeping that yeast alive and bar. The funny thing is that one of the most popular distillery now, where literally all their bourbon products are allocated.
Yeah.
You know that is? Their entire bourbon portfolio is allocated.
I don't even know.
Including the Special Reserve.
Oh, Weller?
Yeah.
Really?
So Buffalo Traces, they use boxed yeast, like a dry yeast.
Yeah.
And so that whole concept of limestone water and a yeast culture that's been kept around for 100 years, they're like, no, just order on Amazon, you know, Red Star box yeast or whatever. And they're bucking any preconceived notion you thought you had about what is making bourbon taste like bourbon.
Yeah.
And no one can quite figure out how. And I think they're doing 1,000 barrels a day right now. They are filling 1,000 barrels a day right now.
That's crazy.
Oh, it's amazing. Like, visiting that distillery was one of the most wild experiences for me, because I was like, you know, you have all the stories and the iconic bottlings and all this sort of stuff, and then you go into the distillery and it's like, holy shit, this thing is massive. And there's a guy, one dude running it in a little like control room, and he's like watching computer screens. And I'm sure he is better at watching those computer screens than anybody ever. But
how are they doing it?
Yeah, one dude just like pushing a button on their friggin' massive still.
Do you guys want to try another wine, or do you want to move on to the other bourbon or the bourbon?
Either way, we're good to go with
it. Yeah, we've got one segment left. Let's jump on I kind of want a little bit more wine, but I'll definitely, you know, we can do both. This is I'm the only one that's finishing my drinks. This is hilarious. Oh, no.
This isn't our first
miles to go before I sleep, first my morning friend. Meeting,
So this is one of the barrels that they did, or one of the wines that they did in Fusion Barrel.
Can you hear him? A little bit. Say that again.
This is one of the wines they do in their Fusion Barrels. And if you look up Fusion Barrels online, it's
basically just a barrel that they put together with American oak, Hungarian oak, and French oak.
They pulled staves and kind of...
So before they even ordered the barrel, they were having guys in the winery break down American, French, and Hungarian.
Right.
Build it back together. Then they were aging the wine for anywhere from 12 to 18 months, then blending it and bottling it. And they said, there has to be a better way. And so what they did is they went out and they found a cooper who would actually combine all three of those staves so they could order all the new oak and just age the wine in the fusion barrel. So if you look up fusion barrels, the very first one that comes up is Glenn Hugo giving a testimonial about this company and how they're doing different things with Zinfandel and Petit Sirah in those fusion barrels. So that hopefully it creates a better quality product. This is one of the first releases that we've got with it right here with the 2014 Old Vines Inn. And whenever Glenn came into town, I actually held back a couple of these to make sure that I had this first release of it. So
there's a...
that's weird.
What's weird?
The state. Like the idea of a fusion barrel, because it also relinquishes some control over all of that, right? Like winemakers, if you're using different barrels, if you're using some American, some French, some Hungarian, some Slavonian, who the hell knows, like... you know, pick your oak of choice. Most frequently you're aging in, you know, some of it's in French, some of it's in American, some of it's in new barrels, some of it's in old barrels, but then it's the winemaker has the opportunity to taste all those things and blend, which is an art in and of itself, right? Is how do you make the bottle the perfect wine based upon the ingredients?
You're removing the human factor by doing that, by doing it.
Yeah, preemptively. By putting those staves in, like swapping out the staves, creating this fusion barrel, you don't have any influence over that anymore. Like how it tastes when it comes out of the barrel is how it's going to taste. So that's an interesting choice.
What if you're doing multiples? Couldn't you just blend multiple?
Exactly. So what they do is they age everything separately and they have fusions as the base. So that's where Glenn was saying.
Exactly. You can kind of tweak it a little bit.
Yeah, but I'm curious what the benefit to it is.
Well, the idea is to create a consistent product from the very beginning is what Glenn told me. Like we don't want to have any kind of barrel things that are getting crazy in there. We want everything as consistent as we can to see if it works. This is all a project. This is all just fun stuff to see if it happens and it actually takes. So it'll be interesting to see as we come up with bourbon, you know, in my opinion, and with scotch and all of these other things. What if we're breaking down port and sherry barrels, rebuilding them and aging scotch in port and sherry barrels rather than just one of each?
Well, you can't. You know? They're actually doing it at Whistle Pig. They're doing the Old World project. You can actually blend. Well, they may just be blending it. I don't know that they're doing it by staves, but you can blend your own whiskey. Some of it's Sauternes, some of it's, I think, Sauternes.
So you can blend different finished whiskeys.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I don't know if they're doing any. I thought they were breaking down barrels as well, but I may be totally making that up. I'm making that up. But you have an issue there.
Just say it anyways.
Yeah.
What you're saying.
Yeah.
But they're also all different size barrels, so there's a problem there too. I mean, you're basically you're going to have to recreate that stave somehow.
Yeah, it's a little challenging.
There's a lot of innovation happening right now, and some of it's going to be hit or miss. This actually reminds me, I'm not a big mead guy, but there's, I think, a place, it might be in Texas, it might be a Texas adjacent called Superstition Meadery, and they do something called Peanut Butter Jelly Crime. And it's a peanut butter and jelly mead taste, and it reminds me of this minus strong notes of peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
But the jelly side of it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's a mead bottle that's popular in the bourbon world where, you know, like $30 for mead, which I think is on the high end, expensive for mead, but it's got a picture of, you know, it's like a crime scene chalk outline of a sandwich, and it's just a peanut butter jelly mead, and that's, I'm getting that grape jelly jam notes from this. That's pretty
for sure. Yeah, it's a fleshy wine.
Yeah, it's definitely a little intense. You know, and the wine world is different too. We talk about classifications in whiskey. We have straight, we have bottled and bond, we have all of these things. You know, same thing in the wine world. When David is out there, somebody brings him an Old Vines Zinfandel. That doesn't mean a single thing.
Oh, really?
Old vine could be 12 years old. It could be 7 years old. Usually it takes about 7 years to get something right.
So let's do this. This is my favorite part of having these discussions is informing the general public of bullshit.
Ooh, yes.
So tell me some of the bullshit you see. Some trigger words that are well known, but they don't mean anything.
Golden Reserve. There is no such thing as a reserve level of wine in Argentina, and a Golden Reserve anything from Argentina or reserve anything does not mean anything. So keep that in mind.
There is a not frequently used classification, but and it, which means something, but it doesn't actually mean anything. There's the in the United States, anything that says reserve, old vine, vintner's reserve, any of that stuff, none of it has any sort of
meaning.
Correct information.
They're just trigger words.
Yeah.
Correct.
So it means something to the winery, I guess, and so maybe, it, but it, old vine could mean. Well, yeah.
What are your thoughts on the recent massive popularity of canned wine?
I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I mean, at Good Night Charlie's, we have kegged wine, and yeah. people are kind of. I actually just did a training for 60 Vines up in Dallas. They have, like, I think it's 60 wines on tap, which is crazy, and people are still trying to wrap their heads around that. I think, you know, canned wine I have no problem with. Most of it is intended to be consumed young. I'm not saying that all of it's good. Like, there's some real garbage out there that's getting canned, but there's some really delicious things. I mean, I'm a big fan of Ramona. I mean, Jordan's a friend, and that stuff's like organic grapefruit juice, wine spritz. It's delicious.
Yeah.
I mean, is it like really serious wine? No. I mean, some wines are meant to be contemplative and some wines are meant to be consumed happily and
just enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, I had this conversation with my sister, which is hilarious because a brief anecdote where she and sorry, throwing you under the bus, sister, but it's
no one watches the show. This is just for my,
this is just for us. Yeah. But she was, you know, really going out of her way for organic produce with her kids and like really making sure that she was, you know, super focused on what they were putting in their bodies, but she was drinking garbage wine. And I was like, you do understand that they absolutely cover those vines in pesticides and chemicals and everything. And like, there's a whole series of wines called From the Tank, that are imported by Jenny and Francois, and they are French wines produced by, most of their producers are super touchy-feely producers in the south of France, and they're totally reasonably priced, and they're delicious.
Where do you get them at?
Probably Houston Wine Merchant around here. Talk to Antonio.
Oh, yeah. Houston Wine Merchant is great. We're doing a barrel of Compass Box with them.
Ooh, right on.
Yeah. That's awesome. Houston Wine Merchant's great.
Are you seeing, this is a total digression, but I just got some samples from Bar Hill, some of their Tomcat barrel-aged gin, because we're going to do a barrel selection with them, because I think they're super cool. I'm curious what other spirits you see, like, that direction going, because gin, barrel-aged gin is, like, that's not a thing you see a whole lot in the market.
So there's, correct. It is, we're going, and I've said this before, part of, I don't think I've said this yet on the camera, but part of what we did today is, today, Houston's absolutely exploding in the realms of all things spirits related, and spirits includes wine and beer. We've got a massive beer scene here. We've got a great bourbon whiskey scene, but that whiskey scene encompasses scotch. It encompasses rum. It encompasses brandy. You know, there's been a few barrels of Copper mm-hmm. and King's brandy that we've done that were extremely popular.
Yep.
I got two of them.
It is all things liquor related are just doing very well here. But two particular gins, well, I mentioned Iron Root before.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best product they make is their, it's my favorite product from them, and I'm blanking on it right now. It's their, the blue, Robert's again, he's screaming at his radio right now. So they laid some vodka down as their gin base in a barrel, and it ended up yielding this beautiful product. A genuinely complete accident.
Before doing any botanicals, so just the vodka?
Correct. So it's barrel-aged, essentially barrel-aged vodka, and it tastes like fantastic whiskey made from Texas, but it's not whiskey at all. Like,
yeah.
And I'm forgetting the name of it. Starka, Iron Root Starka is what it's called. But they do barrel selections of that cool. was their gin base.
Yeah.
Copper and Kings does a barrel aged gin program where you can awesome. Pick out a single barrel of it.
Yeah.
And NASA did it. And I've never been a gin guy. And I just happened to bite the bullet and buy this cask strength gin from NASA Liquor and from Copper and Kings. And it was the most floral and vegetal and just awesome
super cool.
experience. Yeah. So it's happening more and more.
Awesome.
I wouldn't mind doing some gin from Citadel, from Plantation, if they ever came out with that program. But yes, so I'm seeing it more.
It's interesting.
There's a lot of people doing a lot of everything lately.
Yeah.
So it's I wouldn't be surprised.
We've been having a blast. So Felipe, our chef, and I went up to Vermont. It's my home state. So it was like going home a little bit to play and support the local guys. But we did a barrel of Whistle Pig, and we're doing a barrel of Bar Hill, and then sending them to Shaxbury to fill them with cider. And then
fun.
Age that for a bit, which is super cool. And then we're going to take the cider and have a cheese made with it, which I'm super stoked.
That sounds great.
But anyway, all the playing with barrels and stuff, I think it's totally interesting. And they're doing a lot of Vermont oak, which is like not been a thing that exists
for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
interesting.
It's
Vermont oak, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Exciting times in Houston for sure when it comes to this hobby.
Well, and I mean,
the food scene here is just
the food scene is amazing, insane. But the spirit scene has been incredible. I always feel like such a dilettante. Like, I study wine as much as I can, and I study spirits. I sell a lot of spirits right now, but every time I talk whiskey, I'm like, I always feel like, God damn, I have so much to learn.
So
still.
I have an idea that we're pitching to, and this is, I realize how premature this is and how naive this is, but I have an idea that we're pitching to Netflix, where it's essentially like Ugly Delicious, except it's centered around spirits. There's all these different phenomenally proprietors of certain bars and restaurants that are doing a lot of great things in the spirit world over the past, you know, for years. I forget the name of that place at Seattle, Canon. These people would be great to sit around a table like it. Have you ever been to Wheezy's Table? Wheezy's Table they have a wine room in the back. That'd be perfect to shoot like a... You know, like what Chris Shepherd did with Ugly Delicious. Just sit down, have food, and then talk spirits. Like, get something interesting or fascinating. And
take it apart.
And just pick it apart. And it's essentially like Anthony Bourdain, but strictly centered around whether it be wine or rum or anything.
Sure.
And so we want to shoot. At minimum, it would be fun just to shoot it. But to shoot a pilot to pitch.
Yeah.
Where it's at some beautiful place in Houston where it's just a conversation like this. Over food and just pull spirits apart. I think it would just be it could be a complete vain attempt at anything, but I think it'd be fun and interesting.
So some of the best ideas start, right?
Now, what is this?
So just pouring up this is our second release of the Redemption we did. So in 2013, MGP, from where we're from, they actually developed a weeded bourbon. And so that's what this item is right here. So it's 51% corn, 45% wheat, 4% malted barley, aged for 4 years. And it's just the second release that we have. I love it. It's 94 proof, a little bit higher proof. I did a little squirreling around and asking some people at Redemption, hey, are we laying this down to do a little barrel proof program or some kind of special release with this? So we are laying some down as well for an extended amount of time. Sure. But I love it. It's delicious.
It's a very easy drinker. Reminds me of there's almost like a – and this is the wrong note for sure. You ever hear – there's some people who will use the same descriptor. We're describing the same thing, but you use a different word than what I use.
Sure.
It's got a chalky, limestone-y note to it that reminds me of Bullet. You know, back when Four Roses was distilling Bullet.
Are you talking about their bourbon?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I mean – in the one thing that's cool is that with this edition, I actually have all four major mash bills that most people are playing around with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anybody else. And I was actually going to ask you, do you know anybody else that has four mash bills? I've got weeded, high rye, low rye, and a rye.
Roses has...
Roses has 10. They have 10 mash bills.
They only have two bases and then five different yeast strains.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was just thinking base mash bills. I think I'm the only one with
Buffalo Trace has two. AD Laws has three that I know of.
Okay.
But I'm not a fan of AD Laws. Yeah. Anyways, listen, we've got to take a quick break. We've got to go. Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, David. Absolutely enjoyed it.
It was great being here. Thanks so much, Chris.
This is my favorite part of life. Visiting with folks. So thank you guys so much. Cheers.
Awesome.
Cheers.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.